Your Eminence Cardinal Spellman, Ambassador Austin, Secretary Forrestal, Governor Dewey, Mayor O'Dwyer, and friends of Governor Smith. This gathering has for its purpose a salutation to the memory of Al Smith by those who knew him or who have carefully studied his character and life work. I had the pleasure to meet him several times and enjoyed long talks with him on men and things. In those days, he had been four times governor of the state of New York and had been defeated as candidate for the presidency. He spoke to me, not without feeling, of the lack of continuity in American public life for party leaders. The unsuccessful candidate for the presidency, although he commands the hopes and esteem of nearly half the nation, often has no public sphere in which he can carry forward all the prestige and allegiances he has gathered in a nationwide campaign. With us over here, it is different. And in many cases, a prime minister falls from power only to walk 4 or 5 yards across the floor of the House of Commons and carry forward his work as leader of the opposition. Now, I have a great respect for the American Constitution. But in this instance, I must confess that I definitely prefer the British system, or perhaps I should say custom, for we have no system. I had followed Al Smith's contest for the presidency with keen interest and sympathy. I was in the fullest agreement with his attitude on prohibition. I even suggested to him a slogan: all for Al, and Al for all. Now, he certainly was a man of the highest quality of brain and heart, who rose under the free institutions of America, as anyone has a right to do, from humble beginnings to high, long, and successful executive office. To be chosen 4 times governor remains a record for the Empire State. His devotion to the religion he had learned as a child was perhaps a hindrance to him in a political appeal to the vast and varied American democracy. But it was the comfort and inspiration of his life and his many private virtues and gaiety of nature and personal charm hung on this golden thread. He loved his fellow men and was capable of giving them the noblest forms of service and sacrifice. Long may his memory be cherished, the mighty city of which he was a shining and faithful sun. Let me turn from this great American to the causes, which I'm sure were he with us now, he would have made his own. We have traveled a long way in opinion since I spoke at Fulton under the auspices of the President 18 months ago. And many things which were startling or disputable then have now become the foundation of dominant Anglo-American thought. During all this time, the Soviet government have poured out through their radio in 26 languages, and in all the speeches made on their behalf, an unceasing stream of abuse upon the Western world. And they have accompanied this virulent propaganda by every action which could prevent the world settling down into a durable peace, or the United Nations organization playing its part as a great world instrument to prevent war. Indeed, the conference is a late success. Perhaps prematurely named, have become a form in which reproaches and insults are hurled at each other by the greatest states. Hurled at each other for all mankind to hear, if they care to listen. But some of them are getting tired. I've been much puzzled to know why it is that the Soviet government have taken this violently aggressive line. From an external point of view, it seems so foolish. And we wonder what is the real motive behind it. I cannot myself believe that it is the prelude to war. These 14 men in the Kremlin, who rule with despotic power the vast populations and territories of which they are the masters, are very capable and well informed. If their minds were set on war, I cannot believe that they would not lull the easygoing democracies into a false sense of security. Hitler was a master of this. And always before or during some act of aggression, he uttered soothing words or made non-aggression pacts. Therefore, while I cannot exclude the danger of war, I do not think the violent abuse which the Soviet government and their communist adherents all over the world lavish on all existing forms of civilization is necessarily a sign of danger or of imminent danger. It is more likely, in my opinion, being used for internal purposes. If there are only 14 men, all eyeing one another, deeply conscious of the enormous populations they hold in chains of mind and spirit, enforced by terror, it may well be that they think it pays them and helps them to perpetuate their rule by representing to the otherwise blindfolded masses of the brave and good-hearted Russian people that the Soviet government stands between them and a repetition of the horror of invasion, which they withstood when it came so manfully. Now, I devoutly hope that this view of mine may prove to be correct. But the United States and the Western democracies of Europe will fail to profit by the hard experiences they have undergone if they did not take every measure of prudent defensive preparation which is open to them. While taking all necessary steps, and above all maintaining a solid front, we should not, however, be hasty in abandoning our hope in the United Nations organization. It may be that the Soviet government and their communist fifth columns in so many countries will at some moment or other quit the United Nations organization. Then there would be what is called two worlds. And we should all be sorry to see that. But if one of these worlds is far more powerful than the other, and is equally vigilant, and is also sincerely desirous of maintaining peace, there is no reason why a two-world system could lead to war. I must now say a word about my own country and yours. First of all, I ask you to pay no attention to the many insulting things which are said about the United States by the communists and crypto-communists and fellow travelers in our eyes. Their interests and their instructions naturally lead them to say everything in their power to make division between us. you should completely ignore their taunts and jeers. For instance, I noticed in the newspaper that our words from a Mr. Priestley, who gained some acceptance in the war from the fact that we used him for broadcasting purposes. He has no interest. No American should allow himself to be irritated or offended by such diatribes. They do not represent in the slightest degree the feelings of the British nation, or I may say, of His Majesty's government. We have a socialist government. You may have heard of that. And I'm leader of the Conservative Party in opposition to it. Perhaps you've heard of that too. But I can tell you that there is no country in Europe which makes a firmer or more solid front against Soviet and communist encroachment than Great Britain. There is no doubt whatever that the government and the overwhelming mass of the British people at home and throughout our Commonwealth, if any great issue should arise affecting human freedom, would act with the United States in the same solidarity and fraternal intimacy which has so lately given us victory against the combined dictatorship of Germany, Italy, and Japan. I believe that Britain will rise again with even higher influence in the world than she now exercises. I work for the revival of a united Europe. I am sure that the English-speaking world can weather all the storms that blow. But above all these, a world instrument, in Al Smith's words, to weld the democracies together, can be erected, which will be all-powerful, so long as it is founded on freedom, justice, and mercy. And it will on.
Columbia has brought you a special broadcast in connection with the annual Alfred E. Smith Foundation Dinner.